This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 109th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am super pleased to have with me today Bart Pernille. Hi, Bart.
Hello.
Bart Pernille is a full professor at KL Leuven University, a university formed in 1425. Professor Pernille has published over 200 articles, has participated in more than 20 research projects sponsored by the European Commission. His main research issues are cryptology and information security. Bart's lectured all over the world in 40 different countries, and he lives in Leuven, Belgium, where it's the height of spring. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Leuven is a beautiful little town with an interesting history, lots of beer and lots of students since 1425. What's it like to be part of one of the oldest universities on planet Earth?
I think it's a privilege and an honor to be here. And of course, we have an engineering department, which is not as old. It's only a bit more than 100 years old. But of course, we do have faculties of law and theology and so on, which actually go back to the 15th century.
Amazing. Amazing. So are there ancient traditions that us young upstart countries like the United States should adopt?
I'm not so sure. I think universities have been evolving. Of course, some things remain the same. We still have traditions of wearing gowns at public defenses of PhD students and at the opening of academic year, but I'm not a big fan of all this gown wearing.
How about the beer drinking? That seems like a good tradition.
Yeah, it's a good tradition, and we want to keep that, of course.
So let's talk about security engineering, applied cryptography, and software security for a while. Do you see differences in general approach, including pedagogy, between the EU and the United States?
I think there is a very big difference in what kind of research is being done. And the US is very strong in systems research, mm-hmm. in security, while in Europe, I think we are more strong in formal methods, mm-hmm. and so more abstract stuff in computer science. And then in my particular favorite area, cryptography, I think the work in Europe is much more applied. There is many more people who build concrete systems, work on cryptanalysis, for example, and develop secure embedded hardware and software.
I see.
So I think this may go back to a tradition where it was hard to get funding in the U.S. for crypto research, especially cryptanalysis.
Right. And so the tradition in Europe was better funded. And also, I think I'm interested in pushing on that formal methods thing a little bit. Why do you suppose that is? Is it because engineering is slightly more mathematically based in the EU?
I think many computer science departments grew out of mathematics departments. And so this may explain the fact that they have a bigger incline for more theoretical work and formal methods. And I think also there was this tradition of leaving professors alone and not forcing them quickly to work with industry, which I think has changed now. But I think this may have been a climate that was more prominent in Europe.
I see. And so the kind of interaction with Silicon Valley certainly changed the face of computer science in the United States a whole lot.
For sure. And of course, there is European copycats. I mean, University of Cambridge has now many spin-offs. Of course, they never created a Silicon Valley or something as big, but there is quite some companies around. And also, even this university is proud to be very highly ranked. So the Leuven University also has more than 100 spin-offs and has a quite close interaction between industry and university.
Yeah, I think it's important to have some interaction with industry so that you know what applied systems are going to look like and influence the way that they're designed. But I also think it can go too far sometimes if the curriculum is dictated by, for example, certifications for system administration of a certain database or whatever. Do you have that pressure in Europe as well as we do in the States?
I think this pressure is not there at all. I think here there is quite some autonomy in education. I think the education program changes very slowly. There needs to be consensus that go up to all the level of universities. So sometimes it's even too slow, I think. Mm-hmm. But I don't think there is much influence of industry on the exact program that's being taught. I mean, we do encourage internships and collaboration with the industry. Mm-hmm. But the core curriculum, we try to stick to foundations, and the idea is that the more applied stuff, people will learn very quickly to pick up in industry, actually.
Right. Yeah, I kind of like that. So you've been in 40 different countries and lectured in 40 different countries. How seriously is the notion of building security in taken in those 40 different countries? You know, what does the range look like, and are there any outliers that are worth remarking about?
Well, of course, there is a very big difference in culture, but I would say there is also a very big difference in over time. So, I mean, I've not visited all those countries in 1 year, of course. So I think the country I've seen where actually people were most behind was Cuba. Very interestingly, these people actually, during their master's program, they were writing software which was then sold to the Venezuelan government. And this was, I found out, medical software, and these people had no clue about cryptography. This topic was kind of forbidden in the university.
Wow.
And so I guess I was one of the first people to teach them crypto.
Uh-huh.
I think in general, you see, of course, in Asia, Japan and Korea are very much advanced. China is catching up very quickly with the awareness, and the investments there are massive. Uh-huh. There was research groups I visited 6-7 years ago who had a handful of people, and they now have a plan to grow within the next year to 500.
Wow.
So there is a major investment there. I think India is still pretty slow. They have the base research, but on the applied side, they're weak. I think you can say the same about Russia, in the sense that the universities are very much focused on mathematics and theoretical work, while, of course, there is quite some applied work there in the industry.
Yeah, I found that when I was in Russia,
too. So overall security culture is being developed everywhere, I think. It's very hard to not see it in the news that cybersecurity is a hot topic everywhere, and I think everywhere governments are responding to this.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's a very interesting observation. So you seem to have a passion for hash functions, including your love RipeMD160. But I'm trying to figure out what's so interesting about hash functions. Maybe you can tell us.
Well, I kind of stumbled upon those. I mean, I got interested in the topic, in fact, when I graduated and I started in grad school as a PhD student. I graduated as a master. In fact, within a few months after starting my work in crypto, I was asked to do a review of a Mac algorithm for Swift together with some more experienced people. And that's how my interest in Mac algorithms rose, and then that's extended to hash functions. So it was more driven by actually consulting contact with industry. But I find it a very fascinating topic because hash functions are cryptography without keys.
Right.
So it's very different. In crypto, you always hide something behind the key, but a hash function is crypto with nothing in your sleeve. There is no secrets, so it's harder in some sense, and the failures are bigger. So if you make a miscalculation, if you don't have enough rounds, then in fact the failure is miserable, and we have seen many miserable failures. There is this kind of theorem or result we derived is that the half-life of a hash function is 9 months. While if you look at other symmetric primitives, their half-life is typically a couple of years.
Hmm.
Yeah, so my advice to PhD students is that they should actually design their hash function at the end of their thesis and not in the beginning.
It's kind of like a trapeze without a net, I suppose. Crypto with no net.
I guess so.
That's interesting. Did you finish your book yet?
No, I don't. I mean, I keep running into more exciting projects from one to another. And I mean, the field also has evolved a lot. I mean, at some stage, I got very close. I think now I would have to start again, lock myself up for a year and write it. But I don't see that happen very soon, I must say.
Yeah, I have the same problem. I've got two books that are trapped in my head, and I just don't see the time to ever write that stuff down just yet. So maybe in the future. Let's talk about quantum cryptography a little bit. Can you tell us about what the current state of research and development in quantum cryptography is and what the implications to applied crypto and system design are, very briefly?
It's not really my core area of research, but I've happened to have some very enlightening and interesting discussions with people. I was invited to speak on classical crypto at the Quantum Crypto Workshop in Paris.
Oh, cool.
Last September.
Cool.
So it's a very cool concept in any case. So people use entanglement of photons, so very intrinsic properties of physics, to actually have secure communication based on the laws of physics. So there is no mathematical assumption in those systems. In the beginning, it was seen as a curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
But now, in fact, there is commercial solutions.
Hmm.
And of course, these solutions have quite some limitations. So the bit speeds are quite low. They're limited to distances of, say, 100 or 200 kilometers.
Mm-hmm.
And this is over fiber optics. And in open air, it's possible, it's conceivable, but there it shouldn't rain and so on. So there is actually quite some challenges there.
Right.
Now, from a science point of view, I think it's extremely cool because what these people do is they manipulate individual photons. It's hard to imagine something more cool. From the engineering perspective, though, I'm not so enthusiastic about quantum cryptography because it does buy you long-term security, but the system is very limited. I mean, we're not used to have communication security dependent on the distance. And also, it actually assumes you somehow have already a key in place.
Mm-hmm.
So there is many limitations, and also the systems are quite expensive.
Right.
So in the long run, if you can build quantum computers, then you will also have quantum repeaters. And then you could actually make global quantum communications, and then it would be a very interesting thing to have. But we're still at least 10 years away from having a quantum computer.
Right. So no real impact now on applied cryptography, but it could change everything, I suppose.
Well, these people do have a market. I mean, there is some banks and governments who are interested in very high levels of security. Of course, it's done over quite short distances and for dedicated optical fibers. And something else that's been discovered in the last years is that, of course, some of these devices have side channel problems that from actually physical emanations, you can still find the secrets, which are supposedly protected by physics.
Wow.
But physics can fight physics.
Huh.
And also that some of the proofs of security of these schemes actually also have flaws or shortcomings in certain models. So in the end, it's very cool. It's based on completely different things. But it somehow follows the same approach as classical cryptography, which is learning by trial and error.
Yeah, yeah.
But hopefully in a few decades, we can get far enough and really get working systems.
Yeah.
That are really secure.
Well, thanks a lot. I know it's not your area, but I knew you'd know something good about it. Those of us who are not cryptographers always have to ask you guys what's really going on. So tell us about the major research projects in your research group, COSIC, and what you guys are working on.
So it's quite a large group. So in total, we have now 65 people, and I have three colleague professors, so there is many things happening. In the area of crypto, many people are now working on the Caesar competition, which is kind of a smaller, informal competition following up on AES and SHA-2 or mm-hmm. SHA-3 competition.
Mm-hmm.
And Caesar is about authenticated encryption. So in fact, cryptographers know already from the 80s that you never want encryption only. You always want encryption and data authentication. But somehow we never had a good construction and we apply those things separately. And so at the moment when the internet protocols, security protocols were designed, we had separate solution with a MAC and an encryption mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Then about 15 years ago, some better solutions finally emerged, but it was a bit too late and they are patent encumbered, so there is some problems. And so what we're using today is actually suboptimal. It has certain performance problems, or it has some robustness problems. So the idea was to start a competition, open competition, and our team and other teams submitted entries, so there is in total more than 60 schemes, and now, and it's more or less the Olympics of cryptography, the battle is started in trying to break schemes and trying to measure schemes and so on. And so this is a very exciting research topic on which several of our team members are working on.
Yeah, that sounds fun. Anything else you want to talk about from COSIC?
I'm very excited about work we do together with our computer science group on secure embedded systems. So what we're doing there is have kind of platform modules where we combine crypto with software security methods to make sure that code can only enter a module in a certain place and no other process on the machine can read the data or the code.
Hmm.
And you have certain guarantees about the code, and this is all achieved with a very small overhead, which consists of some key registers and some MACing algorithms or in the future authenticated encryption algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is low-cost crypto together with some very simple crypto mechanisms, software security mechanisms, excuse me, and those together can actually give you quite interesting assurances.
We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. You've also spoken, I think in China and other places, about what has changed about applied cryptography in the post-Snowden world. And I think that'd be interesting for us to talk about for a bit. So what do you think the implications of the Snowden revelations are for crypto?
In some sense, I mean, Snowden didn't tell us great secrets. I mean, the NSA people come to our conferences since the very beginning. And I mean, we knew how their building looked, and we could guess how many people were working there. But I still think we were all surprised by the levels of sophistication. But I think we were all surprised by the level of sophistication and by the things they do. And I think we had the image of passive listeners. But I think the image that comes out of the Snowden documents is active hackers.
Right.
And it's also not only hacking the bad guys, they hack anybody who's in their way between you and a potential target. Mm-hmm. So even if you're a system administrator in a telco company, you can actually be hacked because this telco company may have data streams that interest the NSA and their friends.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's definitely changed our look. I mean, we had this, in crypto, this Dolev Yao model after a famous paper of the early 80s, which more or less says that the network is taken over by the adversary. But we actually never thought this would ever happen, but I think what we see in the Snowden document is a picture where indeed the NSA owns the network. And if you type google.com or facebook.com, you don't get the answer from them, but from the NSA, mm-hmm. because they're faster.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of attack, of course, was imaginable, but the fact it would actually be deployed and used on a large scale, this is actually surprising us.
Right.
So I think we really need to be much more careful about deployment and about our schemes. And then, of course, they have surprised us by undermining Stanford's efforts. I think the big story there is a dual EC random number generator from NIST.
Absolutely, the one that showed up in the RSA
exactly.
pile. Yeah.
I think what is surprising for me is that, first, they've been so blunt to do it, because I don't think it was a very subtle approach. I think it was actually discovered quite quickly, but strange enough, NIST didn't respond fast enough.
That's not strange if you know NIST, but yeah.
I mean, also for NIST, the stakes were very high, right? I mean, they had a reputation to lose. I think with the AES, they finally acquired a very good reputation in cryptography.
Mm-hmm.
And by responding so slowly, I think they actually
damaged themselves.
Dampened their reputation.
Yeah, interesting.
But I think also the crypto community, we kind of stood by, we watched, we saw it happen, we complained, and then nothing happened, and we actually just ignored it.
Yeah, and it showed up as the default algorithm in some cases when unsophisticated users would not unselect it, right?
Well, I think that surprised me the most. So there were, in the standard, there were four schemes, three based on semantic crypto and one based on public key crypto. And I don't think I would ever have recommended anybody to use this public key scheme
mm-hmm.
because it's just way slower. Which means you also have more risk with side channel attacks, with timing attacks, and I mean the cost is much higher. So I thought this was maybe reserved for a few very exotic government applications. So I never imagined that it would become the default choice in a widely used library, for example.
Right, right. Yeah. So these things all taken together, what are the implications for system design now? What can you do?
Well, I think something else which I haven't mentioned yet is that in crypto, we teach our students to protect secrets authentication by protecting a key. But what we now learn is that there is something called a security letter. A security letter essentially is a letter that says, give me your key, and you can't talk about it, or else you go to jail. And so, of course, we don't know about those letters, but we do see some people who actually decide to shut down their business. So
yeah,
they
the
can
lava
kind of
bit
indirectly
guys. For
example. That's one example.
Yep.
We can actually deduce indirectly that they got such letters. But of course, I can't imagine that a big company getting such a letter would shut down their business.
Right.
So it means if you shift all your secrets to a single key, that you have to take into account the risk that an agency will come and get this key.
Mm-hmm.
So we should actually use techniques which have been developed in the 80s and 90s is distribute your secrets over multiple keys and make sure that ideally those in multiple jurisdictions or under control of multiple entities, so it becomes much harder to actually get control of the key.
Yes.
I think this this lesson of put everything in one key, I think it's a big mistake.
Oh, know, that's very
at
good.
At least for those sophisticated environments.
Right, that's very good. What's another lesson? That's a very good one.
Well, I think in general, it's also about open implementations. I mean, we have discovered now many things. But in the end, if you have a closed source implementation, or either a hardware or a software module, if you see what this opponent is prepared to do, what kind of risk they're prepared to take, you should actually look with even more distrust at anything which is closed source or which is a closed hardware box.
Right.
So the probability or the temptation that a backdoor is in there is so large that you could have to almost assume it is there.
Hmm.
And so I think for me, it actually pushes us, we should have for our security implementation, we should have open source. Of course, Heartbleed and Pulse is not enough. You also need strong governance for this open source.
Right. That's one of the challenges with open source, if we're talking about, say, the GNU license or whatever, is that the economics don't really support the security engineering required to get that stuff right. Being open alone doesn't just do it.
For sure. I think that's something which was clear for a long time, but kind of people implicitly assumed that this would not be the case. And just kind of, what we often do in security, we just ignore problems. We claim they're not there.
Right.
I think we now have the problem in front of us. And I think the solution is, I mean, I don't know, I'm not a big fan of asking money from the government, but I think already before Heartbleed, I spoke out in public and I said there should be more funding for this kind of code reviews.
Right.
I think it's if the big corporations don't do it, then I think the government should intervene and make funds available for code reviews for this code base.
Hmm. That's interesting. Did you get any traction with that idea?
Well, I put the idea forward in European Parliament, and traction there doesn't happen quickly.
But you're from a university from 1425. You guys are pretty patient there in academia.
I guess so, yes.
let's switch gears to something silly. So tell us about the Journal of Craptology, which sounds very fun.
Oh, actually, it's the premier journal in its field. I got involved with this at the very beginning. I think I'm now long passed over responsibilities I had there. But I think it was inspired in part by the RUB sessions. So the crypto conference, they always have an evening session with impromptu talks. And they tend to be now more of the type, I have this great result, but I only get 5 minutes to tell you. But like about 10% of the talks used to be incredibly funny because many people in the crypto community have a good sense of humor.
Right.
And I think then the idea was, why not write those stories down so they actually can be more widely read? And I think this journal seems to do quite well. I mean, it doesn't appear very regularly, but at least the articles in there are mostly very funny. Depending on your sense of humor, you may like some more than others. But I'm very glad that Journal of Cryptology exists, and I think it has a great future ahead. The only thing which I really regret is when you write a review of a really bad paper, I'm always tempted to write, this paper would be a great feature in Journal of Craptology. One step too far in insulting the author, so I kind of have been able to refrain myself from doing that.
I think you should do it. I think that's very funny. Last topic. So you play the saxophone and you conduct big bands. Who knew? So when's your next performance?
Well, actually, May 8th, we have our annual concert in Leuven, so we organize each year our own concert, where we expect a couple of hundred people, and
cool.
we play actually with a professional musician as a soloist.
Oh, great. Who's going to be the soloist this time?
It's a Belgian flute player, Stefan Brakeval.
Cool. That's fantastic. And are recordings available of the band's work?
Well, there are some on YouTube, and some I wish they would not be there, but I think there are also some nice ones over there.
You don't get to pick and choose. Maybe they can be
well,
the sound.
People have cameras these days, right? They take recordings and they dump it on YouTube.
Exactly. It can be part of the soundtrack of the Journal of Craptology.
Exactly. Some of those would fit there very well.
Well, thanks. It's been a fun conversation with you, Bart. Appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital, an IEEE security and privacy magazine, and syndicated by Search Security. The March-April 2015 issue of IEEE S&P Magazine is a special issue devoted to the Oakland Security Conference. The issue also features our interview with Whit Diffie. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.